Good morning, Ithaca, Watkins Glen. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Jeff Collins. Jeff, it's good to have you here this morning.
It's good to be here.
So, Jeff, what we start with is the question, who are you? And that can be taken in many ways, from labels you wear to qualities of your person or things that you aspire to.
Well, I was expecting this question. You sent it ahead of time, and I guess at the most basic level, I would say most people in town who know me from the fact that I was a social worker at hospice care for 20-odd years, retired in January, almost a year ago. Some people would know me as a counselor. I've had a private practice for most of those 20 years, and that I'm continuing. And some people would know the fact that my wife Gisela and I co-lead silent meditation retreats. We're going to do a 6-day retreat over New Year's at Light on the Hill, and then we do a summer retreat at a place called Southern Dharma in the Carolina Mountains. Oh. So that's kind of I guess you could say the more obvious things about getting to know.
Right. And it's a way to start.
Yeah.
And it's a way to start. So you also brought some music. And you want to start with a Tibetan dance piece. What about that piece?
Well, I mean, it's actually music by Gurdjieff. He wrote the music.
That's the name. The title is Tibetan Dance.
And it's performed by a pianist and a cellist and a percussionist. And I just plain like it, but it's got a quality of both joy and focus. So those two things together.
And focus.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
And that opening piece is called Tibetan Dance. And our guest on this hour is Jeff Collins. Jeff, you described that piece as holding two qualities that you very much enjoyed together, joy and focus. And why does that give you delight, or how does that give you delight?
Well, it gives me delight before I can say how, but
I'm
glad of that combination because how to say this? I've followed a Buddhist path for a number of years, and early on I encountered somebody asking him, I mean this is an old story, somebody asking a master, what is the way of Buddha? And he said, great intimacy. And the great intimacy to me is a quality of, you could call it focus, you could call it steadiness, whatever, but it's also, it's an intimacy with what lives, and that's the joy. So that the two of them have this sense of, being really of one substance.
Right.
And that music to me brought it out.
Right, right. And sometimes when we think focus, our worldview, kind of our view narrows. But you mean intimacy, which means that it can be receiving from the full peripheral vision.
Absolutely.
At the same time.
But so, far less distracted than usual.
Right, 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 right. And in a certain way, aware of the branch that may be falling or the leaf that may be dropping, but not being distracted by that.
Or aware of the leaf that's falling and the wind on your skin and not per se being distracted by your worries, your various mental this isn't that.
Right. So not letting a private distortion intrude on this experience.
Right. And the habit of that distortion.
Right. Right. And the key there is the habit.
Exactly.
Of the distortion because
exactly.
And being able to step out of yourself in a certain sense or to open yourself.
Right.
Might be another. I mean, all of these things are metaphors which are useful and also have their own challenges. So tell me, how did you come to this Buddhist practice? How did you come, what is the experience that has brought you to this point in your life?
Yeah, and that's central to it. Came relatively late in my 30s. I had lived a very, very middle-class life for a while, dropped out and became a photographer and spent 10 years doing that. And happened on, and this was in a time when there weren't so many books, happened on a Zen book with some of the old stories. And it was like coming home. And just started reading it and then read some other books. And I happened to be reading in a coffee shop run by a woman who had a Zen group. And she noticed. And I started practicing with them. And then once I started practicing, I entered what turned out to be a 7-year period of very intensive practice. 4 years in Zen and then 3 years in longer retreats, 3-month silent retreats. I did three of them and shorter ones.
And so I get from the length of the retreats intensive practice, but what was intensive about the first years? What do you mean by an intensive practice?
I was going to roughly 5 of the 7-day retreats they had in Zen. Each year, and they're by definition intense. They make them that way,
right.
And things happened. But then, it started to feel limited to me, and I started to do another kind of practice, which led into the 3-month retreats. I went to social work school in that time, in order to do hospice work.
Right.
And just as I was finishing social work school, my father died and left me some money. Not enough for a lifetime, but I could sort of do a sabbatical. So I went to the first 3-month retreat, then went on to the second one, and that's the one that had the most profound effect on me. When I started meditating, I was kind of hoping to meditate my way out of, I guess you could say, the suffering of this world. And as I was doing it more, and that intimacy work began to be deeper and deeper and deeper, by the time of the second 3-month retreat, I got you could say this was almost like the wisdom side of the practice opening. I got a sense that there is no escape.
Right.
And then after a bit, the compassion side of the practice started to come in, and a deepening sense, it would suck if I could. So this sense of a turn back to the world.
Mm-hmm.
I got that, for instance, there's this great Mahayana Buddhist vow, beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. Mm-hmm. That actually that's a vow of eternal participation, this sort of coming back in and participating.
Mm-hmm.
After that period, let me just say one more. Sure. After that period, I got married and to somebody I'd actually met at the end of one of these retreats. And we came here, got a job here. And after a year or so, discovered another kind of spiritual practice called Diamond Heart. And I've been doing that now for 21 years. And
what is Diamond Heart? It's, briefly, I want to go back to some other things, but let's continue on.
So it's a practice. It's a whole big school. A lot of the teaching I don't particularly vibrate to, but the teachers I encountered, I had a profound sense of connection from the beginning. My two main
with
teachers.
With the people, and not so more than the teachings.
But the teachings are really, they're wonderful in one sense that they really emphasize the personal.
Mm-hmm.
They're one of the things they bring forth, what they call the pearl beyond price, which is a Sufi image. And the pearl beyond price is, you could say, a particular human presence that's basically awake, as opposed to, you know, carried around by all kinds of conditioning, reactivity, that has become awake in its humanness.
Mm-hmm.
So the universal, there's actually a line in one of the Buddha sutras, you know, in the unborn is ever already the personal, and in the personal is ever already the unborn. And in there was a technology in this new tradition that I was in, and also these two women I was working with were just deeply embodied that sense of the personal and the universal in one place. So
mm-hmm. We're going to come back to that because that idea is the stretch between the personal and the universal actually skirts past the institutional and the structural mm-hmm. where most of us are living our lives, and we try to those of us who are activists, we try to make the institutional change when it's enveloped or surrounded by the personal and the universal.
Mm-hmm.
It would be my way of mm-hmm. putting it. When you described your first being drawn to meditation and the practice, you were in some sense, and in your first 3-month retreat, you were hoping to escape the mm-hmm. world. Mm-hmm. What changed inside of you that escape didn't seem what? Because escape is a pretty compelling desire.
It is.
What allowed you to let it go, or what invited you to see something? What changed inside you?
In the second retreat, the second 3-month retreat, in the first thing that was happening, its term in Theravadan Buddhism is anicca dukkha, a deepening sense of the utter impermanence of everything. It's called insight meditation, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. the insight is actually an insight into this fundamental quality of impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
And in that impermanence, there is absolutely nothing you can grasp. And therefore, there is no escape. Everything.
And there is no reason for fear.
There is no reason for fear, but even if there's fear, it itself is impermanent. So right. Everything is unfolding, and it's ungraspable. And it's a kind of a depression that can settle in because there's nowhere to get to that will not dissolve under your feet. That, I think the Christians would call that the dark night of the soul. And I was working with a teacher who was wonderful. She just basically said, keep going.
Right.
Keep going. As deep as the sense of a despair became. She actually once told me, one of the great Tibetan masters said, enlightenment is the ultimate disappointment, which actually helped.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, some kind of a clear space just opened, and a moment of happiness actually came. And in that, I mean, it was like almost incidental. And in that moment of happiness, this great upwelling of joy
mm-hmm.
in the sense of that space.
You made a connection to Christianity, which I think was dead on, that sense of the impermanence of everything, and the dark night of the soul mm-hmm. is often a way that that's, but that's also called a prelude to the experience of grace.
Yeah.
In Christianity, which is you act not with the intention of control, but you're a being that acts. And what is the right. what is the nature of your activity?
Right. And I think that's what Meister Eckhart would call the incarnation of Christ at yep. that moment.
Yeah.
You know, so it's always happening when you're out of the way, in a sense.
You're doing it, but that self that's preoccupied is not
exactly
preoccupying yeah. yourself.
Yeah. yeah. And after that period of joy, I had this time of really, it's almost like an awareness resting over mystery. I don't know how to describe it, but it was like this sense of this inky black presence, thoughts, I could watch them come up, and the sense of this stupendous energy coming out of it that was silent, but it was almost like it was roaring. I mean, I've never had an experience like that before. A bit later, one of the teachers described a situation where she had been at this beautiful forest, been there a number of times, and came back, and it was clear cut.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense of the that hit me, and I wanted to go back into the, you might say, the more clear space, but the wouldn't go away, and I just more or less said, to hell with it, let it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And let go of the breath, and then trees started falling, and then it just was like several days of moving into one World War II atrocity after another, just letting that bathe over me. And that's where that turn seemed to happen. I mean, it's still happening,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but that turn back, and you brought up fearlessness. It was the beginning of the beginning of a kind of fearlessness with regard to this profound suffering.
Right, right, right. And by looking intimately and deeply into violence without having to try to fix it, you can, I think, experience that quality that you're describing, because it means allowing these things to unfold and the forces to play, and those fields that were bombed and devastated in World War I and World War II mm-hmm. have never gone back into agricultural production because they're not safe.
Right, and I mean, you have Auschwitz sitting yeah, right there. Yeah, you right, have yeah, Rwanda yeah. sitting yeah, right there. Yeah, these things yeah. have happened.
And they continue to happen, yeah, and right. we continue to carry on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost too strong a term.
The thing where it became personal for me was in the sense of the actual felt sense of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
That the feeling was, and God knows it wasn't a choice, but that the feeling was moving through me. In a Buddhist term, you would basically say love is one of the fundamental things we're assembled out of.
Mm-hmm.
And when that love meets pain, it's affected. Not destroyed, but affected, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. that affectedness is what was moving through me then. And there's actually a place where Buddha said that the reason enlightenment experiences, meaning transparency, an experience of transparency, the reason they usually close is we can't take the pain, because we're open to the whole universe. And it's like a circuit breaker throws, and you might keep going and get ready and have more capacity the next time it opens. But
at some point you shut down.
Yeah,
and you come back to it.
And you come back, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've, in my work in the emergency room and with people coming in from all sorts of violence or just mm-hmm. unexpected death or unexpected tragedy or crisis, each time seems to allow for a little more depth.
Right, right.
And a little less fear or need to anticipate. Mm-hmm, and powerful.
Yeah. And at the same time, I just want to say it was like an aspect of coming home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, I think most of us live a lot of our lives like a cat on a hot tin roof. You know, this universe, I don't want this one. I want to somehow hop out of this one.
Right. And I'm not happy here, and I'm not sure where I'm going to find happiness, and I'm going to keep looking.
Yeah, and just keep dancing. And this sense of this turn, and I mean, that this is probably a forever process, but this turn back into this living universe, this place. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I meant by part of the wisdom of that there is nowhere to escape to. And, you know, ultimately that, okay.
Right. There is no place to escape to, and you can be here.
Yes.
In the midst of the Auschwitz-like, where your guts are, in a sense, gassed.
Uh-huh. Right. In that unity, and you're also where there's a beautiful little haiku that goes, in this world we walk on the roof of hell, gazing at flowers. And that sense of here are the flowers, here is the hell. And it's not like one is like a Pollyanna thing. They are flowers.
One does not
they are
put
hell.
The other one away.
Yeah, exactly.
One does not pollute or contaminate or in any way change the wholeness of the other.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Those are very hard lessons.
Yeah.
And those are the lessons that traditional religious spiritual practice, persons who took their spiritual practice seriously, learned, regardless of their religious tradition.
Right.
We have lost them. Modernity really did a number on our tendency to want to solve problems or fix things or escape.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Let's turn to some music now. What should I play next? What music should I go to?
Well, and given that we've been somber, try Oblivion.
Okay. Okie doke. And do you want to say anything about that before I play it?
Well, it's a tango. It's by Astor Piazzolla, and it's also just simply lovely.
Yes. I beg your pardon, I'm having a few technical difficulties here this morning. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. I'm your host, Eric Clay, and our guest on this hour is Jeff Collins. Jeff, I was so immersed in our conversation and in trying to hold that kind of eternal, big, universal picture and the particular that you had described so clearly, and I lost track of my ability to know how I was running the board. Mm-hmm. So I tried to play the music on a line that it wasn't on because I got distracted. I couldn't pull back in. And there comes a point in one of these kinds of conversations where the most honest response is silence. Mm-hmm. Until you have, in a certain sense, the focus or the... And by that, I mean a narrow focus to be able to take the next step, because mm-hmm, we walk mm-hmm. with both a combination of the universal focus and the highly particular mm-hmm, one of where we put our foot and how we adjust it to the gravel or the mm-hmm. concrete or the uneven surface or something that breaks or gives way that we don't anticipate very much in the moment. That's a quality of living that... one gives oneself over to. And from my experience, it's built largely on a practice of either silence or of meditation, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. generally involves silence for mm-hmm. me. How have you say that you and your partner lead silent retreats. Right. How has silence shaped your life? How does it continue to shape your life? And how does its practice give form to other yeah. things?
So the practice, I mean, for most of us, for a very long time, the practice is a practice of almost like interruption. The Buddha said that actually the one thing in this universe that has a possibility of permanence is the way the mind conditions itself from moment to moment, because it's moving in like this flow, these... Mm-hmm. Flowing like water, but it's got a sense of continuity. So the core function of most basic meditation, and probably in a certain sense final, is to create a gap in that. And the gap is at first almost like staccato. I mean, it's basically...
It feels like a break.
Yeah, it is a break. Yeah. It's meant to be a break. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, some of it is just literally breaking the momentum of the flow. And it's not terribly interesting to the flow, and that's why people get so bored. But it's meant to break that momentum. It's also based on the idea of an underlying intelligence, and that underlying intelligence in those gaps begins to notice things. Mm-hmm. It will notice, for instance, the quality of impermanence. It will notice, for instance, the sense of space in the gap. It will sometimes notice fear coming up around the gap. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm used to having a certain kind of an entertainment, even if it makes me unhappy. I'm
conditioned to expect that.
Yeah.
And I take some pleasure.
Right.
In that.
And I'm conditioned to expect a kind of ground that moment to moment, every time I take a step in my mental mm-hmm. mind, I'm going to meet the ground. Well, these gaps start to break that sense of ground. Mm-hmm. It's not done just out of, to get concentrated. It's not done with the idea that somehow you're going to be a better person. It's really to basically create this gap in the flow and to be there with a kind of an underlying level of intelligence that starts to notice things.
In traditional religious terms, it's called trust.
Yeah, right. Right, and trust, you know, trust is an interesting thing there, because to some extent what you can encounter...
You cannot predict
yeah,
if you're living
exactly.
by trust.
Above all.
Yeah, you cannot predict.
And that sense of the groundlessness, for most of us, it's pretty terrifying. I don't know, there's a whole psychological theory called terror management theory that basically says that human beings faced with this sense of the unknownness invent all kinds of things, like traditional religion that explains the
mythology
universe.
All this
yeah.
stuff
yeah. So we've got it all explained, and this is actually stepping beyond the explanations into, you might say, a kind of naked experience mm-hmm. of just this
right.
just this
right. I've I had the beautiful experience of going to a seminary where we had faculty who were both trained anthropologists, one who studied with Margaret Mead as well as Paul Tillich, who could take the creating that experience, the structure, and then beyond the structure, was the point of ritual. That was the point of sacrament.
Uh-huh.
And that's a very different experience than a fundamentalist experience of religion.
Right, right. Yeah, so this just sort of this naked actual experience, the thing that really, 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 really landed on me in that second 3 month retreat that I was talking about a bit ago, is that all of the, so I'm in a Buddhist tradition there, mm-hmm. and all of the stuff in that tradition really comes down to this is about us, the living human presence.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly evolved, et cetera, on this planet and things like this, but sort of gathered here with this capacity to experience the mystery that brought us here. not explain it, but experience some sense of the presence of it, the experience the energies, experience in a very, very immediate way. Go ahead.
And I want to say this because there are some people with more of a science background that when you use the word mystery, you might lose them.
Yeah.
But in the practice of science, when you get results that you cannot explain, you merely hold them without trying too much to judge them until they sort themselves out.
So mystery...
And mystery has this quality that I can experience it
yeah.
without explaining it,
exactly.
without defining it, and I can live in it. And then some things are going to come out new after I kind of come out the other side. But then but there'll be a new mystery.
I mean, it's my impression, and without saying too much about science, that somebody like Einstein was absolutely suffused with this sense of mystery.
Yeah.
I mean, most of science is fabulous at the mechanics of things, but it really, you know, it would be hard pressed to say like how one moment gets to the next or what is bringing this whole thing into being.
What you are talking about in terms of the universal and the personal
mm-hmm.
is the preparation of the self to practice,
mm-hmm.
to practice anything. Whether it's hospice care or nursing or scientific research.
Exactly.
And we don't take time. We are the number one instrument of our lives, and we oftentimes don't take time to learn how to use the instrument that we've been given.
Exactly. So the thing, like with most science, as people are sort of saying it in this, in quotes, reductionist way,
sure.
There's a kind of a materialism, and I think it's writ large in our culture, that's not per se about like wanting a Porsche or that kind of thing.
No, but it's an awareness of material existence.
Yeah, and it's basically sort of having a sense that the universe is made up of a bunch of dead BBs and that we're an artifact of dead BBs. And as I understand it, most scientists or people of that inclination who are saying it's just material don't take science far enough, because as I understand it, science, if you go far enough in physics, you can't find anything there except relational energies.
And that in pop culture, that hovers on two sides of Einstein's approach. But what I want to pull it back, for me, I'm a human being, and I can't know anything that a human being can't know. But I'm also, and as a human being, I tend to know things in three fundamentally different sorts of ways. One is with my intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And science is very good, mm-hmm. and things, and materialism is very good for stretching our intellectual skills. I'm also emotional. And emotion is orthogonal. It's at a right angle to intellect. Mm-hmm. Because you can't put intellectual and emotional processes into the same explanation. They work differently. And then there's a third dimension, which is sensorial, taste, touch, smell, sight, all of these things that we can that physically get us going. And that's orthogonal to the other two. So if I'm going to be a human being and I want to communicate with other human beings, I have to work in all of those ways.
Absolutely.
And much of science is reductionist because it's limited itself
mm-hmm.
to that that notion of, is it intellectually verifiable and reproducible, which tends to mean material.
Right.
Doesn't have to, right. But it tends to.
There is another way of knowing, perhaps,
sure.
And I'd be curious what you say about this, what I would call intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... Oh, how do I go into this? There are experiential ways of knowing something
mm-hmm.
that, you know, we don't typically have a context or a language for. Certain kinds of experiences, and when I was saying mm-hmm. that thing around mystery, I mean, I
sure.
would be hard-pressed to say how I knew some sense of something there, but it was almost like it knew itself as me.
Right. Right.
And in that, I'm outside the normal mental way of knowing. There's actually a kind of wonderful explication of some of this. A French writer named Henri Corbin, who wrote about Sufism, really sort of the more profound aspects of Sufism, has a difference between what he calls the imaginary and the imaginal. And the imaginary, and God knows it's writ large in the human thing, it's like within your own human mental apparatus, you imagine things.
Mm-hmm.
The imaginal is like you're in contact with something that's, well, just for lack of a better word, more fundamental, more mysterious. You're in contact with mm-hmm. it, and you're trying to bring it back to a human form. So there's a quality of translation.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, out of this, all kinds of religious people have
right,
an experience
right,
and all kinds of religious
right.
things grow. And again, you could say all sorts of nonsense can come up.
Right.
One experience can produce a religion, and then everyone starts to
right.
take this, the mythology or the metaphor of it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a sense of some kind of contact with something and then a translation. And that's what
mm-hmm.
the imaginal points to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's non-verifiable.
What you have to take the testimony of individuals seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And William James did this, and because he took the testimony of individuals about their experiences seriously, he was in some sense discredited
mm-hmm.
because that's not verifiable and it's not objective. But when you, what you have pressed, I tend to do the intellectual, emotional, sensorial, physical way of segmenting
mm-hmm.
human experience. But whenever you look at it holistically, you end up with the intuitive, the inductive,
mm-hmm.
this experiential learning, which is seeing as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And we historically, we were much more capable, I think, of allowing people to encouraging ourselves to know that way and engaging other people to speak with us in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And part of, I imagine, your work as a social worker in hospice is seeing the picture that the person is bringing
exactly.
to you as the gift of their life as
mm-hmm.
it's coming to an end, and with those around them in a way that only they can offer that gift.
Right.
Because it's the whole.
Right. And in and of itself, therefore, has meaning. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so and that would be spiritual knowledge. Anything that
mm-hmm.
that strives for that holistic element,
mm-hmm.
intuitive, inductive, but not objective, because then you've distanced, you've stepped outside of that whole experience.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, well, anyway, we've wandered some neat spaces. What should I play next? You had wanted to actually, let me, shall we play Why We Build the Wall?
Okay.
Because that may actually help to explain why we avoid this.
Uh-huh.
Or address that question.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a wonderful song for nowadays. Walls are very, very much up, and or up in many meanings of that word.
Right,
and
right.
Also, you're right. I mean, it's got all kinds of interior implications.
Yeah. And the inside plays out.
Yeah.
The outside plays in.
Yeah.
Thank you. do we build the wall? My children, why do we build the wall? How does the wall keep us free? My children, how does the wall keep us free?
How does the wall keep us free? The wall keeps out the enemy, and we build the wall to keep us free. That's why we build the wall, we build the wall to keep us free.
Who do we call the enemy? My children. My children, who do we call the enemy?
Who do we call the enemy? The enemy is poverty, and the wall keeps out the enemy. And we build the wall to keep us free. That's why we build the wall, we build the wall to keep us free.
Because we have and they have not, my children. Children, because they want what we have got.
Because we have and they have not, because they want what we have got. The enemy is poverty, and the wall keeps out the enemy. And we build the wall to keep us free. That's why we build the wall, we build the wall to keep us free.
What do we have that they should want? My children, my children. What do we have that they should want?
What do we have that they should want? We have a wall to work upon. We have work that they have none, and our work is never done. My children, my children. And the war is never won. The enemy.
That's why we build the wall. We build the wall to keep us free. We build the wall to keep us free.
And that was Why We Build the Wall. And our guest on this hour is Jeff Collins, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Jeff, we were talking about, you know, this is the indictment against walls, which I think is an important indictment to make in a world where we are creating kind of a certain amount of violence and thinking that we're both protecting as well as furthering our ends with these walls. But you were saying there's another side to walls.
Yeah, I mean, like the womb is a wall. It's a permeable wall, but a wall, and it allows a baby to happen.
Right.
You know, that this situation.
A personal boundary allows a person to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Skin, immune system, all kinds of things in this world. So it's not quite so simple as, you know, you make everything utterly permeable, then nothing can happen.
Right.
You wind up with kind of mayonnaise. So walls are interesting things.
But it seems to me that our emotions and our minds sometimes need to play themselves out.
Mm-hmm.
So we come up with a piece of music that's extreme
in
that way. Or we come up with a statement that's extreme. I have many times I have loved working with people who were at the rawest edge, because if I don't stop them from going there, but go there with them, they will find the balance themselves.
Right.
But if I try to intervene and stop that, They don't.
Right.
My job is to help prevent violence to other people in that process.
If you can.
If I can. And if I can without compromising something
right.
core.
Right.
And if not, to bear witness.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Powerful for you evoking many, many things in me.
Uh-huh.
With the work in hospice and with your work for 20 years, you retired in January of this year.
Right.
Why? Why does one retire from such a powerful, meaningful kind of work?
I turned 70, which in and of itself doesn't mean I need to retire, although a younger social worker, a wonderful young woman, came in, so it's like making room.
Sure.
But
there is a quality to life of making room.
Yeah, making room. But I guess there were several reasons. I loved being able to have more flexible time. You know, that's a 8:30 to 4:30 job, and I was there 3.5 days, but I got 3 weeks of vacation. Now I have flexibility with time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The way hospice was happening, Medicare was coming further and further into it, sort of pushing it more and more toward becoming merely, and I mean this, merely a medical response to a situation
sure.
that to me was immense. It was hitting the nurses harder than the social workers because of the amount of paperwork they were facing, but it was coming in more and more, and that was dispiriting.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I wanted more time and space for me to articulate things to myself and
mm-hmm.
and read and things. I still have the private work going, and I mean that I have no intention of quitting. I'm not going to quit leading the retreats. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was, and it's with mixed feelings. I love the clinical team that I work with and the other people at hospice care, and I love working with patients. I go up there periodically and see the clinical team and just fall in love again.
Right, right. And as you have turned away from that chapter in your life, what opens for you? What does this space allow you?
To read more, you know, both in the sense of Buddhist stuff, but also, general philosophy and poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I read a lot of poetry. And I'm curious about articulation, not necessarily like writing a book or something like that, but just articulating. I mm-hmm. give talks in the retreats, and there's a kind of process that's wonderful about articulation. There's a beautiful phrase I once heard: naming kills and naming gives life.
And
the second you name something, you can create an artifact out of it, and it becomes a something, and it's kind of dead.
Yeah.
Or you could sing it into a kind of being. And I'm really interested in the kind of articulation that sings life into something, which mm-hmm. means you can't really grasp it, but at that moment you feel something.
Mm-hmm. It allows the word to come and go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And in Christian terms, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us
in
very much that sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not to belabor that point, but yeah, it's very powerful where you are. How does your daily life, I'm going to ask you this. I ask all guests this mm-hmm. question towards the end. We have spent a lot on what the spiritual practices or the mm-hmm. fruits of spiritual practices is not actually the spiritual practices. But what do you do on a daily basis?
So I meditate in the morning,
mm-hmm.
you know, typically around 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing a certain kind of visualization practice for a while in that time and then just sort of sit with silence. And then my wife and I meditate most evenings together.
Right.
I have the working with people in the counseling work, whatever you want to call it, that I do. I mean, almost all of that is what I would call spiritual work.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that to me is real practice. You know, the practice of listening. And it's almost like a core practice. It brings out that intuitive thing. But it's an intuition to contact someone. about trying to be in contact with someone. Mm-hmm. And the thing I'm most interested in, I guess almost in general, is what allows something to flower. What brings forth flowering in according to that other person, or for that matter, the garden, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
There's a Zen concept called Roshin, which means the heart mind of a parent. But you could also say the heart mind of a gardener, where you're studying the garden. You might be pruning if you have to, but you know, what makes this garden grow? What makes it happy? Which means you got to know you don't put a shade plant in the sun just because it looks good. You know, so you're listening to the garden, and yet you're also engaged with it.
Right. So it's the constant dance between the particular and the context and how the two are working together.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
we tend to look at the particulars as preconditions, but what we're really looking at is how do I experience this whole thing so I don't even necessarily know I'm aware of the particular, but I'm reacting to it.
Yeah, reacting to it and dancing with it and feeling its life flow. My main teacher, she had a beautiful quality with this. I'd watch her working with somebody, and it was almost like fingertips on a surface. And the fingertips had a quality of magnetizing somebody to want to, I don't know, be open, be real. And yet at the same time, if something needed to pull back, she would allow it. If something needed to come forward, she would move with it, instead of having an idea of where it ought to go.
And I'm getting the sense that that is what you want your daily practice to be.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
It's an offering, but you're open to what comes back. Or it's an invitation, and you see what comes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What do you do more weekly, monthly, yearly? You mentioned the periodic retreats, but what do you do
well,
to take care of
yourself? Monthly we have an all-day retreat at our place. I mean, anybody can come, but I mean, there's a certain number of people come. It goes from 9 to 5 on Saturdays. I am still engaged in my Diamond Heart work. I go down every 3 months or so for a 5-day retreat. And, you know, I read and read a lot of poetry. I mean, poetry is an amazing thing when it's good.
And do you have particular poets you read, or do you read pretty widely?
I love to happen on them, but yeah, pretty widely. I've just recently encountered a Swedish poet named Goran Sonnevi, who's still active. And he's actually friends with Thomas Tranströmer, the guy that won the Nobel a couple of years ago. But Sonnevi is an amazing poet. I'd recommend him to anyone. S-O-N-N-E-V-I. I wrote a book called Mozart's Third Brain. But things like that, you know, just the sense of a kind of recognition that can come when you're... I mean, most novels to me don't have that in it, but poetry often does, music. A lot of visual art can. So, yeah.
Drawing on your practice and also your experience in hospice and counseling, what does the invitation look like, or the invitation feel like, to people in crisis, when you want to be that calming, you want to invite them into the mystery of their pain rather than the terror of their pain? What does that invitation, how do you be with them? We live in a world that's terrified, and we need to go from terror to mystery.
Right.
How do we do that?
How? That's an incredible question. My basic sense of what a given person working with the world offers, there's a Japanese word called toku, T-O-K-U. It's the Japanese version of the Tao Te Ching. And it's typically translated as power, sometimes virtue. And it's a kind of an untranslatable word. It's the presence that grows in a person over whatever time, through practice, through sincerity, and it invites sincerity. It's got a quality of space in it and a quality of a kind of magnetizing. And from a Japanese perspective, I gather, from what I've read, like, you know, going down to the anti-war meetings in New York City mm-hmm. before the invasion of Iraq. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I could say my toku wasn't strong enough to stop the invasion. And that's not self-flagellation. It's just kind of literal.
Matter of fact.
Yeah, you know, that this sense of this, the magnetizing possibilities of sanity grow with a kind of personal power.
Right. And so in a world of terror and fear, if I bring a calm presence...
And a sane presence, yeah.
A calm and sane presence, then that's an invitation.
That's an invitation.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's as soon as I push on the energies, they push back. Yeah. But the second I'm kind of there...
Then I become an option.
Yeah, exactly. And you hope the intelligence of the situation starts to respond.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
It's been a delight, Eric. Thanks.
I want to play, we want to close with Old Ideas, a piece called Come Healing.
Yeah.
Leonard Cohen. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say anything about that before we close?
I just love this song.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
We'll gather at the brokenness. Breathe into me now the fragrance of those promises you never dared to vow, the splinters that you carry, the cross you left behind. Come healing of the body, come healing of the mind, and let the heavens hear it, the penitential.
Behold the gates of mercy in arbitrary space, and none of us deserving the cruelty or the grace. O solitude of longing, where love has been confined, calm healing of the body, come healing of the mind. Oh, see the darkness yielding that tore the light apart. Come healing of the reason, come healing of the heart. Oh, trouble dust concealing an undivided love, the heart beneath is teaching to the broken heart above. Let the heavens falter, let the earth proclaim, come healing of the altar, come healing of the name.
O longing of the branches to lift the little bud, O longing of the arteries to purify the blood.
And let the heavens hear it, the penitential hymn, come healing of the spirit, come healing of the limb. Oh, let the heavens hear it, the penitential hymn.